can I welcome everybody here today? The program says that from 1:15 to 1:25 there will be introductory remarks, but most of that time has been taken up with the usual technology glitches of transferring technology from one side of the world to the other. So I will make some very brief introductory comments, but again, can I thank you all for joining us for what I think you will find to be a truly uplifting briefing on the work of the Rorowaki Trust. Over a number of years, quite a long period of time, New Zealand has invited people to come to our country under our distinguished visitors, various distinguished visitors programs. And this year it's been our privilege to host some permanent representatives visits based on themes where New Zealand has particular areas of expertise, including renewable energy and sustainable agriculture, two topics that have, of course, been very, very, very significant for us in the context of the Open Working Group on SDGs, within the SIDS, in negotiating the SIDS outcome document, and, of course, are very central to the Rio Plus 20 agenda and the post-2015 development agenda. In the course of those visits, we've introduced our guests to New Zealand organisations with interesting and innovative approaches and stories to tell. Stories founded on sustainable development, and I've got to say to you that you'll find in a moment that the Tuaropiki Trust is one such organisation and indeed is a star. Based near Taupo, in the centre of New Zealand's North Island, Tuaropiki has used indigenous knowledge to develop a resource which benefits the economic and cultural development of its people in an environmentally sustainable manner. That model is the product of visionary leadership and collective ambition. Some of our guests have visited Tuaropiki's operations in the fertile farmlands of the Mokai Valley, just 18 miles from Taupo. If you know a map of New Zealand, Lake Taupo, I think the 10th largest lake in the world, about the size of Singapore, actually, is in the centre of the North Island, and this is just 18 miles away. And it was very clear from those visits that they were inspired by what they saw and what they experienced. Guided by indigenous customs and principles, Tuaropiki has developed a model that has turned its aspirations of sustainable development into action and has made reality of its very significant dreams. And today they're here to share that story in the hope of encouraging and inspiring similar models of sustainable development in other parts of the world. So it's my privilege to introduce from Tuaropiki its deputy chair, James Ataria, one of its trustees, Nichelle Griffiths, but you can call her Charlie, Puawai Warata, who is the daughter of the chair of the trust, who was to have been here but unfortunately couldn't travel at the last moment, and its CEO, Steve Murray. So it's my privilege, and I really do deem it a privilege today, to invite Tuaropiki to share its story, starting with the deputy chair, James.
Tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā tātou katoa. To Your Excellency, Mr. Jim McKay, once again we thank you for your kind words of welcome and introduction to the talk that we will be giving today. Unfortunately, we had a technologies list down today and we had a message from our current chair, who unfortunately was unable to join us today. But he does send his greetings and salutations to you all. And so we re-emphasise those warm greetings to you and for the invitation to come today. It is a considerable honour for the Tuaropiki Trust to come and tell our story to you today, to this, the 13th session of the Sustainable Development Goals Open Working Group. So thank you to that. In addition to conveying our best wishes, we also wanted to wish you a happy Māori New Year. In our country, the Pleiades star constellation is just rising above the eastern horizon, and for Māori, it signals the end. Traditionally, it signals the end of the harvest of our cultivatable crops. It signals the time to sit and remember those that have passed on, and it also is a time to consolidate our thinking with a view to the future. So I think it's therefore only befitting that we remember that the leaders of Tu Arōpaki, they are past leaders of the Tu Arōpaki Trust at this time. Leadership that has been a key determiner for guiding the Trust to the point that we find ourselves today. The meeting is also significant from the perspective of Tu Arōpaki's future, a future where sustainability is becoming an increasing focus for us as a Trust, and also a future that has an increasing outlook on the globe. So, again, thank you once again for the invitation. In recounting the story of the Tu Arōpaki Trust, our business models and our views on sustainability that have evolved over time, it is only incumbent upon us to acknowledge the wider historical and political context from which the Trust has been forged in, especially the traditional Māori relationship to land and the Western view of land ownership. Now, in New Zealand, just to provide a bit of background, land is classified as either Crown land, which is land owned by the state, general land, which is land in ordinary or private ownership, or Māori land, that's land in Māori ownership and subject to the jurisdiction of the Māori Land Court. Now, owners of Māori land are part of a very complex system that involve restrictions and protections that do not apply to owners of general land. And the system is really a product of history arising from the efforts of past governments to reconcile customary Māori ownership of land with individual title system that's based on British land laws. Next slide, please, Steve. Next one. So this graphic really provides a history of that issue around land and land ownership. And I just wanted to run through it because it does provide an important context to the discussion today. So starting at the left, prior to the arrival of Europeans to New Zealand, traditional Māori rights to occupy and use tribal lands were collectively held by all members of the sub-tribe or tribe. New Zealand's founding document, the Treaty of Waitangi, was signed in 1840, and New Zealand became a British Crown colony and Māori subjects of the Queen. After the Treaty of Waitangi was signed in 1840, only the Crown could buy land from Māori. This land was then on-sold to settlers and the profits used to promote further settlement. This was to herald really the start of a shift from collective ownership to individual ownership that would eventually lead to fragmentation of Māori land title. In 1862, the Native Land Act was passed, which provided for the individualisation and registration of Māori land in a form that was recognisable under British common law, so that it could be readily traded. It also made the provision for a land court, although to obtain title to their land, Māori had to appear before the court and prove their rights to it. Crown preemption ceased at this time, and settlers were now able to buy directly from Māori. From 1860 to 1864, marks a very turbulent time period in New Zealand history, a period we call the land conflict. Initially, these localised conflicts were triggered by tensions over disputed land purchases that soon escalated into significant Crown campaigns against Māori. In 1865, the Native Land Act established the Native Land Court, renamed the Māori Land Court in 1947. And this was a permanent forum of formal court record and stated that land titles issued by the court could list no more than 10 owners. Following the land wars, the court was given specific powers to investigate claims of rebel and non-rebel landowners, and land that was owned by rebels was deemed to be Crown land and subsequently confiscated. In 1873, the Native Lands Act replaced the 1965 Act, and this really laid the pattern for the system of Māori land tenure that we know today. The 10-owner rule was abolished and the court was required to list all owners of a block in a memorial of title as tenants in common. Those individual owners could pass their shares on to their successors, and if they died intestate, their shares were divided equally among all of their children. Māori land titles became increasingly fragmented, and many Māori were left with very small holdings, scarcely enough to eke out a subsistence living. Māori, as a result, grew progressively more impoverished, disease was rife, and the population, estimated in the 1800s as anywhere between 100 and 120,000, fell drastically to 45,000 in the 1901 census. So bringing the story back to Mōkai, in 1910, the Taupō Totara Timber Company secured the forestry rights to harvest the Potokarp forest, known as Tū Aropaki. At this time, this agreement was promoted by the Crown or the government as an exemplar of how to engage in business with the local Māori population. And I think this was a very clear demonstration of the Mōkai community's penchant for business and development. Next slide, thanks. However, nationally, the problem of land title fragmentation was significant. To address this problem, the Native Land Amendment and Native Land Claims Adjustment Acts were enacted in 1929. Under this act, government assistance was made available to develop unproductive Māori lands and Māori landowners were encouraged to consolidate uneconomic interests in different blocks of land to create viable farming units under a single management structure. For Sir Apirana Ngata, who was a key political Māori figure at the time, the incorporation was the most viable structure. And by 1939, more than 200,000 acres of Māori land was under development. In 1951, an advisory committee was set up for the Mōkai lands, renamed Tū Aropaki, to work with the Department of Māori Affairs. In 1952, 257 Tū Aropaki landowners agreed to amalgamate their lands that would be jointly managed by their own representatives and representatives of the Department of Māori Affairs. That year alone, from the Māori Affairs, Tū Aropaki was approved. In 1953, the Māori land development schemes continued under this legislation, and provision was made for the establishment of trusts and Māori land incorporations as land management mechanisms. In 1966, the Māori Affairs loan to Tū Aropaki was repaid in full. At a national level in the 1960s, to provide a national and somewhat an international context, through to the early 1970s, saw a rise in Māori protests that I think drew from the civil rights movements that were happening here in the US. The Treaty of Waitangi became the focus of a strong protest movement, which rallied around calls for the government to honour the treaty and to redress treaty grievances. Māori expressed their frustration about the continuing violations of the treaty, inequitable legislation, and unsympathetic decisions by the Māori Land Court. The 1980s saw the handing back by the Department of Māori Affairs of most of the land that had been developed with its financial assistance under its supervision. Handbacks were conditional, though, upon owners having decided and established appropriate management structures. In 1993, the Te Ture Whenua Māori, or the Māori Land Act, was enacted. Under this act, Tū Aropaki becomes an Ahu Whenua Trust. This act reflects the major changes that have been occurring in the direction of government policy since the late 1970s and early 1980s. The main objectives of this act are, one, retention of Māori land by Māori owners, their extended family, their sub-tribe, their descendants. And two, the use, development, control of Māori land by Māori owners and their family, sub-tribe and descendants. The Act also includes provisions for successions, alienations, where the shares that owners who wish to sell must first be offered to the preferred class of alienees, i.e. to members of the family or the sub-tribe that are associated with that piece of land. Three, management structures and methods, such as trusts and incorporations that I've mentioned previously. Four, building on and occupying Māori land. And five, partitions or subdivisions, amalgamations or other title improvements. The Act requires that almost all dealings with Māori land must be examined and approved by the Māori Land Court. Today, the modern Māori Land Court is structured in a similar way to its predecessor, the Native Land Court, but its primary objectives differ substantially from the past. Whereas the Native Land Court facilitated alienation, the primary objectives of the Māori Land Court are as mentioned above or previously. In 1994, the Te Aropaki Trust establishes the Te Aropaki Power Company Limited. In 1996, Te Aropaki negotiate directly with the Crown and purchase the Crown's interests in the geothermal wells on Te Aropaki lands. In 1998, commercial and funding agreements for the Mōkai 1 geothermal power station are successfully concluded and construction of the power station at Mōkai begins. And in 2000, the Mōkai 1 55 megawatt electrical geothermal plant is completed and commissioned, 100% owned by the Trust. So that provides, I think, a very good overview of the relationships and the tensions that Māori have had around land. And I think it provides a nice segue into what Pūwai is now going to talk about, and that's really looking at some of the issues that are faced by Māori society, and that's how we reconcile our cultural values with a prominent Western cultural ideologies, and how as a people we are dealing with that. So I'd like to hand it over to Pūwai. Kia ora.
Kia ora koutou katoa. Greetings to you all. thank you, Jamie, for providing that overview. One of the things for our trust is that we are a family. My father is the chair. Charlie is my cousin. Jamie is a distant relative. Actually, all the board are either my aunties or uncles. So my father always says you can choose your friends, but you can't choose your family. So we're stuck with one another. And we need to figure out how that works. Over that timeline that you saw, there are a number of things happening within our community, but also the wider New Zealand society. And one of those things was around cultural identity and how we sought to ensure its survival, particularly through the areas of tension and conflict, but also coming into a contemporary setting into 2000 and the 21st century. We had a lot of things going on at that time. So you had our traditional Māori values, which were mainly held in our meeting houses in our communities, where the traditional roles of men and women played out. But you also had a lot of urbanisation happening at that time, and also a lot of Western ideas around what family meant. So we talk in terms of whānau. That's a large grouping of families. For example, our trust of 257 would be a whānau. But we were trying to reconcile that with what a nuclear family meant in the cities. So there were those sorts of things going on at that time. What we've had to look at doing is reconciling that. And in the kind of third space that's in the middle there is more of a hybrid model, or a hybrid space where we seek to try and balance often competing value systems and ideas around how things should be structured. More particularly, in traditional Māori society, you didn't own land. Land was a gift. It had its own life force. You were there as stewards of that land, but we've got a trust situation where you've now got individual title. It's basically a property right, and the trustees are there to act on behalf of those owners. And how, again, the question comes back to the trustees, how do we begin to do that, and the management team? In there also you have this thing around leadership. So in traditional Māori society, our leaders were often our elders. They were particularly experts in their fields with regards to health or things of the world, nature, environment. In Western ideology or Western society, I've been brought up that education and knowledge is accessible to all, and you do that by going to university, going to school. In the middle, again, we have this tension that sits where you have the young ones coming through into the boardroom with the older ones who say, "Get back, young person, you've still got a lot to learn." So there are those tensions that happen. Also different ideas around how things should be done. In terms of the governance structures, it's quite interesting. In New Zealand, there's a lot of talk about nepotism. In our board and in a lot of Māori boards, that's called whanaungatanga, which is an extension of family. So there's those sorts of dynamics. And often that's not a good thing, but in some cases kinship is a very good thing. In our case, kinship has been how we've derived a lot of these activities. And our families have remained relatively close in that process. If we go to the next slide, Steve. In terms of the elements that we've, the trust is based on, if we look back, a lot of the things were by inspiration. So our elders were very pragmatic. My father's been in the trust since 1979, so I've been brought up in the trust. And a lot of these key elements, they didn't really talk about them like that. They were always in narratives or in stories. Of course, we've been to universities and put them into boxes and models, and this is how we've kind of sought to look at it. But we did have a session, which was very good, where we brought in Auckland University to run modelling with us on what the future will look like for our trust. And one of the key areas that we identified was around, do we actually really know who our people are now? So in 1952, we had 297 owners. Today, we have 2,200. What is that going to look like in the future? So people was definitely identified as a key area. The environment, of course, the trust, well, beyond, way before the trust, I think, we've always had a affinity to our environment in Mōkai. Mōkai is very interesting because you had the forestry rights. What ended up happening was there was a very large fire in Mōkai and it extended across from a place called Tihoi right across to the lake, and that took out a lot of our forestry and that basically devastated that industry, which is why we looked for alternatives, and farming was one of those alternatives. So environment is a key thing around how do we ensure that our traditional food sources are still going to be there for 20, 30 years' time. We also identified finance, which is around, well, if we want to do all of these things, how are we going to fund that? But also key to our development and also moving forward is relationships. The chair often talks about the importance of relationships. And we've been brought up with, again, this whole notion of kinship and connection and ensuring that those are maintained and fostered and grown. And underpinning all of those elements is our culture and our cultural values, and how one of the big questions for the trust moving forward is how do we ensure that those values remain relevant to a generation that have not walked on our land? How do we ensure that they want to come back and learn about our trust and our lands and our history? So culture has become a very important part of how the trust looks to communicate the core values of the trust. Charlie is going to briefly touch on the why aspects, why Te Arapaki does what it does, and who the Te Arapaki people are.
He tangata, he tangata, te whenua, te whenua. The people, the land, the land. That's why we do what we do. We have no choice. It's an obligation. Something that's been passed down to us by our tūpunas who dared to dream. You know, their dream has brought us into existence, to take a leap of faith in their own ability to determine their own future. And that's why we do what we do, to honour them and to make sure that that dream will stay alive for those who are yet to come. In Māoridom, we say that we whakapapa to the land, that it is actually part of our genealogy, that we come from the land and we return to the land. So it has our DNA in that land. So we treat this as it is a member of our family. So did we look to become a sustainable business? No. We looked to look after our family. And that's how we've evolved. Every decision we've made, be it commercial, be it social, be it cultural, has that built into it. And that's why we do what we do. Because as a family, there's no choice. You must provide. Steve? That is a picture of one of our children, one of our uri, one of our family members. So that epitomises the reason we do what we do. We've been handed a resource, and it is up to us to ensure that that resource is there for him, for his children, for his grandchildren. So for us, why? There is no choice. Who are we? Well, you've already met my cousin. And we are a family. To the point, Puawe illustrated that she grew up in the trust as a child. I also have my nuclear family with my mum and dad and an extended family as well. And I grew up in the trust through that extended family, who was one of the chairmen who preceded our chair that we have at the moment. And they did what they did for us. So we currently have 2,275 owners. We started with 257 owners. We had individual title. That's not how Māori do things. So to bring the land together, it took years of talking to each other and trying to get us to come back to our cultural values of doing things for each other. No te rauro, nāku te rauro, ka ora ai te katoa. By pooling our resources and working together, we will ensure the well-being of all. And that's what drove us to create the Tūropaki Trust, as you see today. The concern we have in becoming a sustainable business is it can't just be an environmental sustainability, because we have an increasing shareholder base. I mean, as you've heard, we started with 257, and there's now 2,275 owners. Now, that's the paper owners, the people who are written down as shareholders. But we consider their uri, or their progeny, has also been our shareholders. And that number is yet to be defined. But we know that it's huge. For instance, I have an auntie who is 80, who has, from her, at least 100 who have come from her, children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, who we provide for but are not in those numbers that you see there. So, as fertile people, currently, it wasn't in the past, that number is going to explode. So to be sustainable for us also means being able to provide benefits for that growing population. So when we look at sustainability, we look at not only cultural sustainability, environmental sustainability, but financial sustainability to be able to provide for that growing base. And we can't separate one from the other. So all of our beneficiaries, our owners, are all linked by way of whakapapa or genealogy. How do we give back to them? Well, we provide education grants, kaumātua grants. And our kaumātua is an elder. And in our culture, the elders are held in high esteem. They are the holders of the knowledge. As Puawai mentioned, that my generation went to university, so we can go there and get knowledge. But there's an institutionalised knowledge that our elders have, elders, that you won't find in a university. It's through life. And so we acknowledge the contribution that they've made in the past, that they continue to make to us by providing some kind of social benefit back to them. We're required by law to give to distribute a dividend via way of shareholding. So if you own one share, you get one lot of money. If you own two shares, you get double. But in our culture, that's not how we do things. So hence the reason that we have these grants. So it doesn't matter if you are an owner with 500 shares, an owner with one share, or an owner with a hundredth of a share, you are able to access this funding for you and for your children and for your grandchildren. The elders who set up the trust made it quite a strategic decision at the time to not take any dividend from the land trust and talk to the trustees about using that money to educate our people so that that sustainability of building capacity from within to move the trust forward in that future. So that was one of the reasons that I'm sitting here today, having been a recipient of one of those grants and now coming to give back to ensure that it continues for the future. So the trust, it didn't purposefully set off to become and be known, I suppose, in our little area of the world as a sustainable business. It just came from the passion and the desire to provide for our families. For us, it's important to cater for our family of tomorrow, utilising the traditional taonga that we have. We have been blessed with a taonga or a gift of a geothermal energy. But there were some traditional uses that happened before we developed it into electricity, such as a puia or a hot spring pool. And so whilst we wish to develop to maintain a financial growth and return for our people, we're very cognizant of not overdeveloping that resource and still ensuring that the traditional cultural use, i.e. of bathing, is still there and able to be utilised today alongside the development that is there. So as a business, when we look at industry and development, we look at it at two levels. One, is it possible? Two, should we do it? Is it going to put that taonga at risk? So whilst we have quite a modest, I would say, in industry standards, geothermal energy company, it's quite strategic that we've developed it in stages because we want to make sure that it is cared for, that it is looked after, and that it is not overexposed, so that it is there for the next generation to benefit from as well. Pōawai also touched on the notion of building strategic relationships. We could not have got to where we are today without seeking out people with knowledge within industries that we don't have as a people or as individuals or as a board. And I'd like to acknowledge at this time a gentleman called Pat Brown from Stretton's Accountants in Taupo, who through this huge development phase, right from 1975, had been with us and supported us as a family through those developments. And as a result of looking for strategic alliances to help us develop our whenua and our people, we also came across this gentleman called Steve Murray, who is actually our first ever CEO. Prior to that, we'd been operating out of the accountant's office as our secretariat, as a pseudo co-chair CEO arrangement with our chairs. So it was a big step for us, a big risk for us to move away from what we know, but it was a move that was actually seen by our owners as us moving into a maturity stage. And for them, it brings us back to it is our land, it is our whenua, and now it is our people running the business itself. So it ties straight back into that self-determination that began this whole process for us. So with that, I'd like to pass on to Steve, who is going to talk to you about what we do today. Kia ora.
Thank you, Charlie. Look, I must admit, it was the first company that I'd seen that had a balance sheet of over $600 million without a CEO, so it was, I was quite surprised. So what do we do to provide the education, the cultural grants, and to deliver on the visions that the Trust has?
So, in keeping with what the what Mōkai was about, we basically are farmers. So we put a little bit of a spin on that by saying we farm above the ground through our telecommunication investments. We farm on the ground through our farming investments. And we farm under the ground through our geothermal investments. So just briefly, from a telco perspective, the Trust is, as you hopefully have picked up now, are very, very innovative in the approach, the structure, and I think the comprehension and management of risk that they take on board. So 2Degrees is a third entrant in the New Zealand mobile telco space. So we are a cornerstone investor in 2Degrees. We also invest in TeamTalk, which is another telco company that's in a stock exchange, or an NZX-listed company, that provides telco solutions for the rural sector. And T-Stream is a very small Taupo-based Wi-Fi service provider. So I don't know how many of you know the geography of New Zealand, but Taupo is in the middle of the North Island. It's a relatively small town. And for a company of our size, trying to attract and retain key individuals is rather hard. And Taupo struggled for a while to provide some core infrastructure. And broadband was one of those things. So we were using a product. We owned the spectrum for a broadband service. And we decided to roll that out to the community, not at commercial rates. It's really a public or a community service. We do charge a fee, but nowhere near as much as we should, to give back to the community, but also to help us and other corporates in the city attract and retain key individuals. From a food perspective, we are, again, the cornerstone shareholder in a company called Midaka. So Midaka is the first majority-owned Māori milk processing plant in New Zealand. Now, most of you have probably heard about Fonterra. Fonterra dominates the milk processing sector from a New Zealand perspective. We are a small drop of milk in the Fonterra bucket. But we're quite proud. We're extremely proud of Midaka, actually. It's been open for 3 years. We process around 1 million 25 kg bags of milk powder. Primarily, everything is exported. Major markets are China, Vietnam, Taiwan and Venezuela. And from our perspective, having synergistic businesses is quite important. So Midaka is the first milk plant in the world to use geothermal energy to dry the milk and create powder. In keeping with starting small and thinking big, we started off, I think, at the bottom of the value chain, which is whole milk powder. After 3 years, we think we've got a fairly good handle on that. And we've now started to move up the value chain. We've just kicked off a 60 million litre UHT plant, again, 100% export. But that's just our incremental way of doing things. Start small, do it well, and then move up the value chain. Gourmet Mōkai are 12 hectares of climate-controlled glasshouses that we have in Mōkai. Again, we utilise the geothermal heat to warm the glasshouses. Produce tomatoes and capsicums that primarily for the export market, 60% are exported to Australia and Japan, 40% to the domestic market. There's an interesting unintended consequence with regards to the glasshouses. So trying to be clean and green and utilise geothermal energy, heat the glasshouses, which is great. But unfortunately, what that does not do is provide CO2. So a conventional way to heat a glasshouse is to burn LPG. That creates heat, and the byproduct of that also is CO2. So we had a CO2 deficiency, which we now have to truck CO2 in and pump it into the glasshouse, but that's still okay. And again, from a food perspective, the great thing about the food sector is it's very elastic, so we can pop quite a few little businesses and investments under this umbrella. And one of them is Vinoptima. So we have an interest in a vineyard in Gisborne, produces what Robert Parker would tell you is one of the top Gewürz globally. And again, that is primarily exported to China and Australia with a small market domestically. From a farming perspective, we farm about 3,400 hectares. And again, the focus there is dairy. We have about 2,200 dairy cows, which provides milk for Meadaka. We have a fairly productive beef fattening unit, so we have about 4,900 stock on the beef fattening unit. And the contours in the Mōkai Valley, there's some quite hilly areas. So areas that we can't productively beef and sheep farm, we run about 7,000 sheep on the area. Again, from a sustainability perspective, fencing waterways, riparian planting is key for us. And also we have a philosophy where waste that we create from our businesses on the land must be catered for and dealt with by us. And that's part of our sustainability focus, which we'll touch on soon. From a geothermal perspective, we've briefly touched on this. So we have a 130 megawatt binary geothermal plant. It's been developed in two stages, Mōkai 1, Mōkai 2. First one kicked off in 2000. Second iteration of the plant kicked off in 2005. And again, from a sustainability perspective, we only take about 80% of what we could take from the reservoir. And the key being is that we're just custodians of the asset today, and we need to ensure that that asset will be productive and strong for next and future generations. I do have a video to play. I could tell you how we create geothermal, but it'd be horribly boring and I'd complicate it. So we had an animation done. I don't know if we're going to get sound, but I'll play the animation and where appropriate, I'll comment. So this should be saying in a much more deeper voice than I have. But this is New Zealand. Beneath New Zealand is a strong geothermal resource. And that predominantly lies in the TVZ, the Taupō Volcanic Zone. And what you have there is Lake Taupō. That's our Mōkai geothermal plant. When we drill wells, we drill down to 2.5 to 3 kilometres, so we go down quite a way. And what we find down there is steam and a fluid called brine. And that is normally at a temperature of about 360 to 380 degrees. We drill multiple wells, so we have about 7 production wells and 4 reinjection wells. So once we hit a production area, we then extract that back up to the surface. And what's again is extracted up is steam and brine that goes into a separator. A separator uses centrifugal forces to separate the steam and the brine. And we process each differently to extract the heat and convert that into electricity. So we first take the steam off and run that into large turbines. One turbine for Mōkai 1, one large turbine for Mōkai 2. We extract as much heat as we can out of that process, but there is still sufficient heat to generate additional electricity. So we have what we call ORMAT units. They contain pentane. We run the steam through. Pentane is a fluid, turns into a gas, and we then use that gas to drive secondary generation. So that goes through to a rather large generator. And voila, electricity is generated. We then take that electricity from our station and transport it across a privately owned 22-kilometre connection to the New Zealand National Grid. And the power we generate will power a city population of about 400,000 people. Once we've extracted all that steam, all the heat from the brine and the steam, it's condensed down. And then about 2.5 kilometres from the primary production area, we then re-inject that fluid back into the into the reservoir over a 3 to 4 year period. That will then heat up and slowly progress its way or find its way back to the production zone, where we will then extract it again. So it's a very nice closed sustainable loop. Right, the next part is sustainability. So as we said earlier, one of our sayings is take care of the land and the land will take care of you. So therefore we have a strong focus on any business that we enter into that is domiciled on the land. We do not take the view that we will then transport byproducts off and make that someone else's responsibility. We will deal with that ourselves. So Midaka, for example, that creates a million litres of DAF a year. DAF is just a byproduct from the whole milk powder process. It's like a fatty fluid. Gourmet Morkai, once we've gone through the picking season from the tomatoes and capsicums, that creates about 2,300 tonnes of green waste. And obviously there's some effluent solids and fluids that are a result of our farming operations. So we take those, and in essence, we apply them to a humble worm farm. We have about 5 kilometres of windrows, which are rows of worms in the ground. Worms love munching through the DAF, the green waste, and the effluent from the farms. Over about an 8 to 10 week period, they convert that waste into a nutrient-rich product that we call vermicast, which is basically a fertiliser. And we then apply that fertiliser back on the land. So what that diagram on the slide is trying to show you is that through all of our enterprises, we have a closed sustainable loop. And again, what I will do is I will play another video, which will take you through the major sustainability components that we have. So again, we're just showing Morkai, or Taupo, sorry. And then looking at the key enterprises that we have. So we obviously have the geothermal power station that we've spoken about, Midaka milk plant, Gourmet Morkai, and the farms. So this just comments that that from a geothermal generation perspective, it's a sustainable closed loop, and what we pull out, we re-inject back. The power that we generate is then pumped into a closed electric. We send it out to the national grid, but we also plug it into our closed local network in Morkai and provide electricity to our businesses. We also provide heat to the glasshouses, as mentioned earlier, where we grow tomatoes and capsicums. And clean steam for the Midaka whole milk powder production. And again, if you're looking for, marketing advantages, you could say that both the milk we create and the primary produce we create have obviously reduced operational costs, but also a very low carbon footprint. Now, this is a visualisation of the worm farm. So five kilometres of worms munching through the product or the byproduct that we create. 8 to 10 weeks for them to do their thing. We then harvest that and apply it back to the land. So we haven't... We just didn't stumble across this. We've obviously made a few diversions along the way, but I think what's really important to get across is sometimes the elegant solutions are the simple solutions, and it's also the ability to prototype things. So we started off with a worm farm as an example with a bag of worms and a concept. That we had some waste, and we thought we would give it a go. And most of the sustainability initiatives that we've fostered have been through a simple, elegant solution, prototyping, and then rolling out on a larger scale. So just briefly to conclude, in no way do we think we have the answers to everything. But what we do think is that we've wrapped a nice, sustainable and cultural story around the things that we do. And what we've discovered that this really is a journey, and it's the ability to dream and design and come up with practical, relatively simple solutions. And as we look back and try and figure out, you know, how did we do that? We've really, you know, we've dreamed of a sustainability program. We've then gone out, and one of the key things is obviously stakeholder engagement and communication. So we've told people the why, the what, the how, and the benefits. Then obviously gone through an implementation program. And critical to that implementation program is then the integration of business processes that you need to wrap around a sustainable model. And then always you need to go back and check to make sure that what you thought you were doing was the right thing, you were deriving the right outcomes, and if not, you modify what you do. But having that feedback loop, that review loop and that audit loop, we think has been quite important and been critical to the success of the things that we've done. Thank you.
Well, you may think you haven't got the answers to everything, but I tell you what, you've got some pretty big answers to some pretty big issues that we're debating right here at the United Nations at this time. Can I just put this into some perspective? Back in 1979, you had a big farm worth about $4 million. You'd paid off the debt, but that's what you had. Today, you've got the same farm, but being highly productive. You've got a geothermal plant generating 130 megawatts of power. You've got a big stake, a cornerstone stake in a cellular telephone business. You've got a radio telephone transmitting business. You've got broadband. You've got milk powder production. You've got glasshouse horticulture. You've got wine production, and you've got waste processing. And today you've got a business worth $700 million. No debt.
A little debt. Appropriate levels of
debt. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, I wish every business I was ever associated with had that track record. Look, you've heard the story. Now it's for questions and comments. Please. Milorad, the ambassador for Montenegro.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Jim, and the New Zealand Mission to organize this event, I think, in right time in this week of Sustainable Development Goals. Particularly, I'm very glad and I would like to greet friends from New Zealand, representatives of Maori peoples in New Zealand from particular region, which I, as a lucky ambassador in that group, last group in June, has a great opportunity to visit New Zealand, but also to visit your land and to learn on the land on your not only tradition. I learned a lot really on your tradition, your history, on that your very difficult history, but full of fights to keep your identity and your connections with land, and that really remind me on New Zealand what I expressed with many similarities with my country in different part of the world and our history. But what is especially impressed for me really and very fresh still when I'm back now 1 month and more from New Zealand, that what I learned a lot on your experiences in current times, how you facing with realities of life now, really improve, doing everything to improve life of your population, how you're growing in that, and that is really extremely valuable example. I must say I am still that under that impression very very deeply, and I'm happy that I learned that, because that is something what I see as an opportunity to use in my country, I'm sure in many other countries. from one side, we know a lot on that New Zealand's experiences in different areas as energy, as sustainable agro-production, agriculture, and all others, tourism, ecotourism, and that concept which we started to use, exchanging experiences, and I'm very happy that as a result of that, my participation in that visit that we recently last weekend realized the first visit of New Zealand Foreign Minister in Montenegro, and that was in Saturday, July, and we are very happy for that. I particularly also, because we have, I'm sure, opportunity. I know from my minister that was very successful meetings with not only foreign minister, with other representatives, with government, and they mentioned, and I think that they open a possibility for our further cooperation in these areas. Really very great example. I today also thank you for your presentations, which added new important information on that your experience. I'm very thankful. And what I would like to say, as from many years before and during this my term in UN in New York, I'm really sincere admirer of New Zealand for many reasons. But after that my visit in New Zealand, I am a very sincere and strong admirer of Maori peoples. And you will have always in Montenegro me and not only me as sincere friends, which will try to not only to keep, to develop the connections between us. And I would like to see in our further cooperation between our countries also your contribution, because that you are, again, experience is really very valuable. We are still, as a country and society, traditional, and having in mind our land, characteristic of our land, etc., we have a lot of to learn and to implement in our some specific realities what you are doing here in different areas. You are really excellent example on not only sustainable development, sustainable life, what you are providing in your area, which we visited. Really, all the best for you from my side, and please go further in best interest of Maori population, New Zealand also. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Minara. What we'll do is we'll gather some of these comments together, and you can perhaps make some responsive comment at the end. Now, yes.
Hi. My name is Lisinka Ulatowska, and I coordinate what's called the Commons Cluster. And the Commons, they're groups of people that operate, they make decisions together, and they benefit from the decisions that they make. And working with the Sustainable Developing Goals, we're talking about the Earth and how we as people can help to make the decisions that are going to work for everybody in nature so that everybody can benefit. Of course, Indigenous peoples are our model. And in many respects, many of us are dealing with the theory of it rather than the practice. And I was wondering, how does it work for you to make decisions with such a large number of people and also share the benefits? How does that process work? Thank you.
I think that's a question that's sufficiently important. We might just isolate it and invite an answer. Who wants to respond on that? Boy? You're an observer of the process, but also very much part of it.
I'm an observer, but I'm also an owner.
Yeah.
So, which is very odd. So my father went to the Maori Land Court and gave me shares so that I could speak. So we have a couple of processes which we can feed back to the trust. So the trustees are seven. Seven trustees that sit on the trust, and they meet monthly. So all the board decisions, all the business decisions get made on a monthly basis or bi-monthly basis by them. In terms of the owners, we have feedback loops via writing into the trust, contacting management, but also through the AGM process. Now, very early in the trust history, it wasn't very easy, so we would meet at our meeting houses, and Charlie's aunties We're very, yeah. very active and very vocal. But what my father often talks about is where it became very difficult, particularly around the power station. This was a very big thing. It was requiring the owners to take on a lot of risk and a lot of debt. And there was a lot of angst amongst the owners around, do they want to do this? Is this the risk? And he's, one of the stories he tells is that he would go to the influential women of our village, and it was the women that would stand up and sit everybody down and tell the board to go. So that's something that we've been brought up at. Well, I've been brought up with that story of my queers, mine and Charlie's queers and Jamie's, being very influential in terms of the direction of the trust. Mm-hmm. And had they not been there, we would still be having a large amount of disagreement. So that's a very cultural thing,
yeah.
and very strategic. And it, I think Charlie touched on it earlier around relationships. So it was who do you go to be able to push and pull on those key decisions. And those key decisions is basically why we are today. And it's still the same. So you have some owners that are very influential in the trust, and it's around making those connections. And when you need them to come on board at critical times, particularly with very large decisions, they're often always there, and they're often always women.
Mm.
Yes. Colin, yeah. The ambassador for Solomon Islands.
Kia ora. Well, you know, I'm also been fortunate to visit the trust at your home, and certainly I think the GDP of happiness is very, very high, and it's something that I think we are grappling at the moment, trying to do that. And when I look at the 17 SDGs that are currently being discussed now, you basically cover everything, you know, from consumption, production, water, energy, sustainable energy, and the list goes on. But I think this is exactly the model that every country is trying to aspire to. And for those, especially for those who have the access to land, connected to the land, I think these are probably the models that needs to go out. So it's, we are really, really pleased, basically to bring this into this house, where sometimes this is where we try to find solutions to many of the problems, but it's not solutions that do not exist. It's out there. It's just that it needs everybody to be aware of. And I'm glad that the presentation have been made. You know, it's amazing. It's amazing to have 2,000 population with a 700 or 600 and something million worth of assets. That is amazing. It's a dream for, I think, of humanity, that if they have freedom from want, freedom to live in dignity, and freedom from fear, that's basically the three pillars that we all seek. And you've done it above ground, on the ground, and below ground. So it's a magnificent story, and it's a story that coming away from New Zealand, we keep talking about that experience, and I'm pleased to see you here. So once again, welcome to Manhattan, and it's very touching to hear this sort of stories. Thank you very much.
Just so you get Manhattan in perspective. Okay. Story about Taupo being the same size as Singapore. Mm-hmm. Manhattan Island is 2/3 the size of Waiheke. It's got, yes. Waiheke is an island in Auckland Harbour. Where a lot of good wine is great. Question over here. We'll pick up on Colin's comments at the end. Question over here, or comment over here.
So, Yeah, thank you very much. I'm Lina from Climate Action Network, and it was really a very inspiring presentation. And as the colleagues from the parties also said, I think there are a lot of good ideas in there that could lead us to this transformational change we are looking for. And I just wanted to refer to some of the ideas you had, because the geothermal energy definitely is a great solution for having renewable energy. So I guess this 100 renewable energy vision that we as a network have is already reached. So it's good to see that it's possible and in reality already happening. And then there were also a lot of other good ideas, like the worm farms and these kind of things. So my question would be, do you think that the solution for this transformational change that we are looking for is having smaller communities, like maximum 200,000 or whatever, and working more in these clusters and having to restructure? Or is that also something we could have at a larger scale? Because, that would be, like, interesting for me to know. And then on the... and probably it's more like philosophical question. And then on the other hand, I wanted to ask, what's the relationship with the government? How much support do you get from the government for the realization of these projects? I mean, the geothermal power plant, did you buy that on yourself, or did you got support from tax?
I think we'll save the scale question and the size question for later, but I think someone should comment on the what do you get from the government? I know the answer. Yeah. Who wants to pick it? Take it. Steve or Jamie?
Okay. So from nothing is the short answer. The entities that we've presented on and described upon, as you've touched on, are rather capital-intensive businesses. So for the power station, the trust has had a history of doing things or being the first to do things. So the trustees of the time, a small cohort, went around the world and sought external funding. Now, you might not appreciate this, but people did not want to lend money to Māoris back in the late 90s or late 80s, probably because they didn't really know who Māoris were, for starters, and they just struggled with the concept of the assets that lay behind the trust, and that's more a structural thing. So the trustees went out. They again, visionary people. And they can tell a good story. So they went out, a group, and we had a mechanic and a few others, and they went around the world and sourced funding from Australia and Japan, so not from New Zealand. Really important, the other construct was that it was 100% debt funding, but zero recourse. So as you may have figured out... Project financing, the land is our asset. We cannot put the land at risk, therefore non-recourse project funding. And that's the same for the other investments and the other entities that we've put together.
As a former legislator, I might add a very quick comment here. What the government did do was provide the structures, the legislative structures within which these decisions were made, within which the trust was established, within which it embarked on its original management plan, which was a legacy of Saraparana, and ultimately finished up where it is today. So the structures were there. But that's no different from a government that passes laws that allow the establishment of limited liability companies or whatever. It was just simply the structural mechanisms. And they were themselves quite controversial in some respects. I mean, I lived through some of that stuff, so I know... It wasn't easy, And as a lot of this wasn't easy, as you saw from the timeline. But the short answer is, as I said, I knew what the answer was. What has the government given them? Nothing. And you didn't ask for it. No. They did it themselves. So, another question or comment? Well, we're coming close to the conclusion time, and what I might ask... Sorry. Oh, yes, Colin.
No, I think before you say anything else, it will be a remiss of me just to acknowledge the assistance that, the disasters. So I think disasters that happen in my own country in which Turupaki Trust actually contributed to in terms of doing something about that. So I just want to place that on record, and it was greatly received by my people and government. Thank you very much. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Colin. I'm going to ask each of our panel to make a very quick comment on what they've heard, the comments that have been made, and perhaps you might particularly pick up on the question of scale or size. How big a community, what size communities should we be talking about here? Perhaps start by someone. You live in Taupo.
I live in Taupo.
Yeah. So just tell them how big Taupo is as a town.
Taupo is 30,000 people, normal population. However, in the summertime, it is a very big tourist destination, and we grow to around 66,000. So that's for the summer months, December through to February, March. So it is quite a...
So that gives you some idea of just local scale. But perhaps we might start with Charlie at that end and just work our way along, and you might have a brief comment to make in conclusion.
In conclusion, I'd actually like to add a little bit to what Steve said in regards to where we got the funding from. The other story that is told by our trustees as they were going around the world trying to find this money is that at every airport, when we travel and go to a new land, we say a prayer or a karakia. And our current chair's name is Tumanako, or Hope, and that's where the money came from, Hope. So that's the way we operate. We keep our culture with us, and that culture pushes us forward. And another analogy he uses is you can sell your strengths, you can sell your skills, but you never sell your souls. And that's how we make our business decisions, and it's how we move forward.
Boy.
Just to pick up on a couple of comments that were made, particularly around transformational change. And one of the things our chair and our trustees talk about is the difference between transformational and transactional leadership. Mm. And he attributes it to the board keeping the eye on the vision and ensuring that the goal is always sitting at the forefront of our minds, and the importance of having those transactional leaders that can look at that bottom line and ensure that from the bottom line perspective that we're all trucking along. And where you have those two aligned, that's when you can get action. I don't know if I'd comment on what the appropriate size is, but I think in our case, not only in our community, but at a nationwide level, we've had some rather exceptional transformational and transactional leaders. Transactional more so now because our generation are all heading to university and looking at those bottom lines, but that's been one of the key messages that our chair has driven into us. But yes...
James.
Firstly, I'd like to, again, thank you for coming and your questions. My summarising comment would be around the sustainability model that Pūawai talked about. And I think today, and it was great to hear your positive feedback on our financial pillar. Very positive, and it provides a good foundation for us. But we remain cognizant that we have three other pillars that sit on our cultural base. So having one huge, massive, solid pillar, it doesn't cut the mustard for us. it's a wonderful position to be in, but we have three other pillars that we want to make just as big, just as robust, and just as strong. And they sit on our cultural foundation. So again, that's our vision. That's where we're going to, and we should never, and we'll never take our eyes off that vision. In terms of your question regarding scale on sustainability, I think it's very much a horses for courses type question. I mean, there's if we look at Te Aropaki, it's small scale. It allows us certain benefits and opportunities to consider some of the sustainable issues, you know, waste, energy, water, biodiversity, social as well. Whereas on a city, it's a completely different thing. But again, you know, looking at New York, you know, you've got, seems to have recycling here. I know I saw people boxing up cardboard and all sorts of things. So there's, I mean, it's different solutions for different sizes of scale and different locations as well. Again, sustainability for us is very much new knowledge, and I steal that term deliberately from a Hawaiian researcher, K-N-E-W, new knowledge. So for us, again, our cultural foundation has all the milestones, has all the signposts. We just need to be able to read them and translate that into our modus operandi today. Kia ora
tata. Steve.
So thank you for attending today. It's been a privilege to host a couple of groups down in New Zealand, and we're actually quite a small, humble group, and we don't actually go out like we are today, believe it or not, and tell people our story, because we believe we've been going for about 50 years, and until we've been around for about 100 plus years, then we think we've matured enough to go out and tell people we think we might have it right. But we were invited across, and some of the feedback we've had from the New Zealand tour was pleasing, where people did like the story, they embraced the story, and they could see snippets of what we were doing potentially embedded back in their home countries, which will benefit their regions. So, as I said on the outset, we definitely don't have all the answers. We are still in learning mode. But if there is anything that that you think you could take away, then please don't hesitate to reach out and communicate with us. We are here to help.
Can I thank the four of you for gracing us with your presence? And I really do mean that phrase. And can I thank the UN family for joining us today on this occasion? And if you want to go away with one little thought, it may sound utopian. Imagine a world of Te Aropakis all joined up together. Not a bad idea.